Hi, I'm Romina Parstek, and you're listening to Drinking and Rushing, Torah with a Twist. And I really think everybody should make French challah toast every Saturday morning. It should be one of the 10 amendments.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
What do you think makes a recipe for a good Torah portion?
Recipe for a good Torah portion? I think you need, like, at least a teaspoon of narrative, and maybe a sprinkling of, like, some poetics. One hapax legomenon, that's always a fun, you know, flavor.
What do you think makes a good recipe for a good podcast episode?
Ooh, I think two co-hosts and one really special guest and some really smart people to, you know, edit it and put it all together.
So you're not afraid that it might be a little overdone?
No. I think, if anything, I think some of the stuff I say is like kind of half-baked.
Or a little salty.
Sometimes.
I wonder if there was a way that we could spice things up this week.
You know, I think that'd be pretty sweet.
Do you think we should get cooking?
Well, I wouldn't be bitter about it.
Oof. And with that, let's get started.
Let's go.
Last week, we were given a lot of rules, and we were told that if we were going to listen to the rules, if we were willing to entertain them open-heartedly, that good things might happen, that we were possibly going to enjoy some sweet rewards, some just rewards. And in this particular parsha, we find that that really might be true, but there might be some struggles to get there. We'll let Gabe get to that another time. For now, I'm so excited to have the sweetness of this particular episode come in and the reward of having a good friend, Romy, be our featured guest today. So Romy, a native of Buenos Aires, Argentina, began her own Jewish education as a student at Tarbut and spent many of her adolescent years at the JCC MACOAJ. She holds a bachelor's degree in early childhood education from Florida International University, a master's degree in Jewish education from Graz College, and was a participant in the renowned Project Zero Visible Thinking at Harvard University. Romy commenced her early childhood teaching career at the Cuban Hebrew Montessori in Miami Beach as an assistant teacher. Romy's been a member of and worked in the South Florida Jewish community for many years. She has been the youth director at the MAR-JCC. She was also FIU Hillel's director and was credited for growing the program's on-campus participation by more than 400 persons. She has been nationally recognized by the Jewish Community Centers of North America with a scholarship that allowed her to complete her master's studies and by our Greater Miami Jewish Federation as Volunteer of the Year for her founding of the Limud Miami, a Jewish learning conference that celebrates Judaism in all its forms. But wait, we're not done yet. Utilizing her culinary interests as an engagement tool, I know Gabe's going to be excited about that, Romy offered an extensive program of Jewish cooking experiences as part of her FIU Hillel and as a teacher. Looking for a creative outlet, Romy decided to return to Argentina and received a degree in baking and pastries. Yum. Romy focused her skills into not only enhancing her culinary skills, but also learning to teach the passion that she has for food, spending the past 5 years developing her passion project, a Jewish cooking curriculum working with JCC's synagogues, religious schools, and museums. Also, maybe seminaries, just putting it out there. Romy is working on publishing her first children's book, The Traveling Afahor. Currently, Romy is working at the MAR-JCC in Aventura, Florida, as the Early Childhood Academy Director. I am so thrilled to welcome you, Romy, to Drinking and Drashing, Torah the Twist. Welcome to the show.
I feel so honored to be here today, so thank you for having me.
It's our honor and pleasure and privilege, and if that didn't whet your appetite enough, I'm going to bring in one of my favorite sous chefs, Gabe Snyder, who loves cooking it up in our kitchen. What's going on, Gabe? And also, what's for dinner?
Hey, Amanda. I'm not yet sure what's for dinner, but I will figure it out by the end of this episode.
Amazing. I'm sure our listeners are going to be really excited to figure out what you've decided, but I'm getting hungry for some information and some great conversation. So let's get started. Hey, Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
I know we're in Deuteronomy, but can we kick it back to Genesis for a minute?
Okay. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I don't know if you know this, but, like, I am a little hungry. It's been a long day of recording. And in Genesis, I don't know if you know this, but do you know what the very first commandment is?
Be fruitful and multiply.
Right. So be fruitful and multiply. That's talking about fruits and veggies and livestock and, like, good things to eat, right?
No, not really. But that's a fun interpretation.
But it has fruit in it.
It does have fruit in it. That's a very good point.
And I mean, isn't this portion talking about, like, you know, being able to have a lot of livestock and communities and veggies and eating until you're feeling, like, completely sated?
I mean, I guess a little. It certainly deals with all of those things.
All right, so maybe I rewinded too far into the past, but if we're in the present, what's this particular portion about?
Well, this portion is also kind of a rewind, talking about the last 40 years in the desert. We start off with a few reminders. One, keep the laws, and God will keep the covenant, making the people numerous and prosperous and safe. Two, you're small and weak, and there are going to be a bunch of other peoples in the promised land, and they're going to be stronger and more numerous than you. But God will be with you with all of the signs and wonders. Three, don't worship other gods. Four, keep the laws, it's important, so we said it again. And five, destroy all the idols. Cool. Well, God's been testing you a lot over the last 40 years in the wilderness, seeing what's truly in your hearts. You had no food, no new clothes, and God punished you a bunch of times, not to mention all the fighting. But God provided food for you to eat, and your clothes never wore out, and you emerged victorious in battle. Well, the test is over, kind of, and God is bringing you into a good land with streams and springs and wheat and barley and vines and figs and pomegranates and olive trees and honey in abundance. So give thanks and praise God. You might be tempted to take credit and say you've earned all of that stuff yourself, but really, it's all God. Don't forget it. If you do, death. God is bringing you into the promised land and is defeating all of the enemies in your way. But it's because they're all idolatrous, not because of the virtues of the Israelites. In fact, the Israelites have done a lot of things wrong, like that time when they made a golden calf and made Moses smash the tablets and Moses had to make new ones. Oops. So what does God want with you? To revere the Eternal your God, to walk only in divine paths, to love and to serve the Eternal your God with all of your heart and soul, and to keep the commandments and laws. Seems pretty easy, no? God commands us to cut away the thickening around our hearts, or to give a more literal translation, circumcise the foreskin of our hearts and not be stiff-necked. God's cause is that of the orphan, the widow, and the stranger. This should be your cause too, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Another reminder, don't worship other gods. God is awesome, so love God and keep God's laws and rules and commandments and causes. Again, mighty hand, outstretched arm, heavy pour, t-shirts and other stuff available at store.drinkingandroshing.com. As long as you do the right thing, you will be strong enough to enter the promised land, a land overflowing with milk and honey. God will make the rain fall to water your crops and feed your flocks and make you prosperous. But again, don't worship other gods. Otherwise, none of that stuff will happen. Also, death. So take those words to heart, and your hands, and forehead, and children, and your thoughts, and your words, and your doorposts, and your gates. I feel like we may have heard those before. As you hold up your end of the covenant, God will remove all the peoples and obstacles standing in your way, allowing you to live and thrive in the promised land, all the way from the wilderness of Lebanon and the Euphrates to the Mediterranean Sea. Nobody will stand against you because God's gonna scare them off. And that's Parashat Akev.
Thank you for the easy rundown.
Yeah, not a lot happening. It's very little content.
No, very simple, very delicate.
It doesn't really go in any direction. It's very straightforward. This is a complicated Torah portion. There's a lot going on, and part of it is because of the timeline, right? Because it's looking backwards, but it's also looking forwards. You know, we don't get a lot of narrative in this Torah portion because there's nothing really happening in the present. We're just waiting to enter. But we're looking backwards, we're looking at all this stuff that's happened in the last 40 years in the wilderness, and we're looking forward to entering the promised land and seeing what comes next.
To me, it's very interesting how for you the rundown or what you take in as the main points of the parasha is that, and maybe from what I'm connecting, you know, it's a part where God is telling us to always thank him for what we are eating after we ate it, but when we bring it or I'm relating, for example, when we work with the kids, that we teach them to say thank you before they eat, right? So in other cultures also, we first say thank you and then we eat. So I think it's interesting to see that perspective shifting in the text.
I'm sure we'll talk about that and a lot more.
Yes, because I have a personal story with that.
Perfect. I'm excited to hear it.
Romy, when you and I spoke about you coming onto this podcast, I said to you, I have the perfect parsha for you. And you were like, what do you mean? And I said, no, trust me. I have the perfect parsha for you. And let's just be honest about it. Judaism and food, a lot of the time, go hand in hand. There are usually kind of two ways that people look at food and Jewish holidays. Type one, they tried to kill us. We won. Let's eat. Or type two, they tried to kill us. We lost. Let's fast. Right? Like, that's about kind of what we go through as we're doing this. But for you, food and Judaism have a much more important relationship and a significant relationship in your life. And so I was hoping you would tell us how it is that you've mixed these two together in your personal and professional life and what brings you here, especially for Parshat Ekev.
I was listening to you talk and I was thinking on how it's the perfect introduction because we didn't talk about this. But for me, Judaism and food are the perfect connection into bringing people together. I think you talk about the two extremes, but with some grace in the middle. I see Judaism as the perfect opportunity to get people around the table and have meaningful conversations. As far as I can go, I always like to invite friends at home. And, you know, I remember my mom setting up snacks and yummy food or lunches for my friends as a little kid. When I was maybe in my late teens and early 20s, I started inviting people at my parents' house, but then it was like, okay, Friday night, let's cook dinner, and then we had a pregame, and then we go out. So it was not just like the pregaming that it was important, it was like the whole meal around the table, you know, it was like maybe six or seven friends. And so as far as I can go, cooking was always important. You know, I would prepare those meals, always include a dessert. When I cook, I can cook for my friends, I can do fish, I can do chicken, I can do steak. So happy for my friends and my family. But if I need, I always thought that if I need to sell a meal, I would never do that. And that's why I went into baking and pastry as like cooking school, because I felt more freedom there, you know, like I can be more creative. And I also felt more welcome through the ingredients. There was something about the meat and the poultry and the fish that it wasn't inviting me. So when I think now that I have kids and I try to look back and forward, like what I want them to take with them, being in the kitchen is one of those aspects, you know, like I look at my part and I think of my memories and I think how my parents, you know, brought us into the kitchen, how my dad involved us into making the barbecue on every Sunday or for like New Year's Eve. And it's not only the act of cooking that will go deep into this, but it's also like all the conversations, you know, like the teamwork, language, math, science, gross motor skills, fine motor skills, patience. And it's an opportunity, and I think even more nowadays, for families to connect together, you know, like we are always in the rush of like getting home, snacks, play, shower, and then meal. Okay, but let's take a minute and enjoy the meal. And the same way over the weekends, you know, like our get together with our friends are, let's have lunch, let's have dinner, or come over, we'll do snack and dinner, and we'll prepare something with the kids. And it's so important for me to have people around the table, you know, the conversations that happen. And I remember one of my first years as a teacher, we were having lunch. And when the kids had lunch, I always enjoyed having lunch with them because I felt, you know, why I'm not gonna sit down and look at them, you know, it's uncomfortable. They need to also see how am I eating, what am I eating, they're learning from that. Maybe they get intrigued, they ask questions about the food that I'm eating. And I had a Montessori class, so it was kids between 3 and 6 years old. And one girl said, Ethan's my boyfriend. And I said, what does it mean that he's your boyfriend? You know, you're like 4 years old, 5 years old, can you explain that concept to me? And you're thinking, okay, they're 5 years old. What do they know about boyfriend and love? And, you know, they said, oh, going to the movies, hanging out, giving kisses. And then one kid said, like, very serious, and he said, dancing. Dancing to very nice music, hugging each other. And I was like, whoa, like, you're only 4 or 5 years old. You know, I really hope that you keep that until, like, you're able to show that. And I remember I spoke with the mom that afternoon and said, listen, like, he said these things, like, where does this come from? And she said, sometimes, not always, when we are cooking the meal, we put music and we might dance with my husband. For me, that was like, this is everything. This is the proof that in the kitchen, all these magical things are going to happen and the kids are going to absorb them. So either they're going to absorb them by watching and being there, or they're going to absorb it in the food because you put that love into the food that you're cooking. So if I need to think, like, what are my passions and what drives my work, it's the passion for connecting people and showing them love through food, you know. Recently, with all the COVID wave and everything, I would send my friends, as they would get COVID, like, deliveries of food, you know. And have you guys watched Encanto?
A very enthusiastic, yes, I love Encanto. My niece loves Encanto. Gabe loves Encanto, but doesn't want to watch it anymore because I've watched it too many times in the apartment. But every now and then, he definitely, like, walks around going, welcome to the family, Madrigal. And so, like, yes.
So, you know how Julieta heals people with a meal? So, recently, I had a friend tell me, like, who are you, you know, Mirabel's mom, that you're healing people with a meal? And not that I'm healing them, but I think it nourishes someone's soul to give a plate of food and also the person who receives it. And it's not a coincidence that we have matzo ball soup when we're sick. And if we think about it, that grandmas or moms will cook matzo ball soup, you know. And okay, nowadays people will go most probably and buy it at a diner or a Jewish deli. But if we think about it, it's nourished food and it's been cooked with love and it's given with love.
I'm just sitting here relating to so much of what you're saying. My father is in education, and my mom in my early childhood was a caterer. She had a catering business. And so, like, everything is flooding back of growing up and education and learning and connecting with family members around the table and cooking as a family. It's such a core memory, personal experience that really can't be compared to, like, really anything else. I just so appreciate the way you're talking about it. The other thing I would add is that I think food is a really great way to, like, grow and to explore, you know, finding out what you like, what you don't like, and sometimes your tastes change and they evolve. And as you grow up, you discover new ideas and new tastes and new flavors. And I just love that when you kind of eat as a family, when you have those moments as a family, you kind of get to go on those journeys together. And I think there's something really special about, you know, a kind of communal journey and a kind of communal or familial discovery. I think that's really special.
Now that I have kids, and when they started learning how to eat and we went through, like, breastfeeding to solids, it was a whole process. Like, where do I start? What do I give? You know, and I didn't want to buy the little jar at the supermarket that had the puree. I can make my own puree, you know, if that's the case. But I wanted them to have solids. And, okay, let's don't talk about the entire cleaning part, because that would not want you to invite you to do solids. But I read that it takes 200 times for a child to enjoy a new food. If you think about it, like, a year has 365 days. Out of those 200, you need to introduce one new food for them to like it. It's like, boosh, like, mind-blowing, you know? Like, so for me, you know, I always remember eating with my parents, you know? For me, dinner time at home was like everybody sitting around the table. When dad came home from work, you know, we will all see, we will all have a meal. And, okay, maybe as a baby, you know, clearly I don't remember, but my memories at dinner, it's everybody around the table, you know, let's talk about the day, let's have conversations. And now I see it also as a way for kids to try, you know, like, every single piece of food that I bring into the table, my kids go, I want it. So my husband is from Spain and he eats a lot of olives, and olives has a strong flavor. You know, it's, to me, it's like the perfect comparison to, like, beer or whiskey. You know, it's flavors that you need to build them. You know, I remember the first time I tried beer or whiskey, it's like, ah, no, you know, like, why am I eating, why am I drinking this? And I feel like kids have, you, if you see them, they have the same reaction. So the more you expose to it, the more people are going to eat it. And the same thing happens, and it's been proven in lots of research. You know, the more that you include, or you cook yourself, or include kids or friends into the cooking, the more they're going to be willing to try those new foods. So Indian food, you know, it has a different flavor, a strong flavor, or jaroset, you know, or jren. Like, we even have food with strong flavors, but it takes persistence and showing that everybody around the table and you're going to eat them. For me, for example, the breakthrough was olives in Israel. When I moved to Israel for 6 months, at home I never ate olives. I have the feeling like I didn't like them. But I was camping at the Dead Sea with 3 friends and, you know, they made the meal and they put the olives. So it was like, okay, either this or nothing, like, you're cold. And I ate them and I remember enjoying them. And since then, I always eat them. So I think even as grown-ups, it's never too late to try a new food. And you know, Israel is that, it's the land of the 7 species. And in this parasha, it's announced, you know, or it's very specific. And if we look through the Jewish food and we start getting like picky, not picky, but like into details, we can see a lot of those 7 foods through it. So I think it's very interesting.
I especially love that you brought up Indian food. So people may not know this, but I did not grow up with Indian food in my house. And the first time that I had Indian food was with Gabe. And this is true. We went to an Indian food restaurant and I said to Gabe, like, I don't know what to have. And he went, don't worry about it. Like, I'll help you order. I'll go with you. We'll pick out things. It'll be great. And Gabe has a habit now of whenever I go away for a Shabbat weekend, he orders an Indian food for Shabbat. But what's really nice is, like, we often sometimes will have Indian food together for dinner, which will be great. And then we have leftovers for like 6 days. You know, it's really funny. I love this idea that you said about trying a food 200 times before that you might be able to enjoy it or like it. And I know that here, it seems like in our Torah portion, and honestly throughout Deuteronomy, like, our people are trying the same things over and over, and it's not always working out for them. Although they're kind of progressing, even like, maybe not always, maybe it is. Maybe it's a 2 steps forward, 1 step back kind of mentality, that they're going forward, but they're always like kind of falling back, even though they're trying the same thing over and over and over again. And so what happens when the recipe just might not be working for you, right? Like, what happens when we're trying to deal with it and we are trying something, but the recipe just, it's not working out?
So one of the main reasons I went to culinary school was because my reasoning was, okay, I can always follow a recipe, you know? Yes, there are some techniques you can master, but you can also master them like trying one time and time again. But for me, I want to learn the science of cooking, you know, like how much butter, you know, like if you put too much sugar in a brownie, it makes like a harder crust. But if you put less flour, it makes them more fudgy on the inside, you know, like these things, it's science. So for me, after, and also during baking school, one of the things I started doing was like recording. Okay, it was like August 9th. I'm going to make this brownie and I'm going to write exactly the quantities of what I'm doing. What's the process? Like every single detail, you're going to write it down and then you're going to try it and you're going to write down like after being baked, how many after you tried. So you need to be in very detail to say, okay, this didn't work. Okay, next time, tomorrow, I'm going to change the amount of sugar and I'm going to try it with this. But you're going to keep everything the same way. And if you don't record it in your journal, your phone, whatever you want to use it, you're not going to remember what you put the day before and you're going to be going 1,000 steps back because tomorrow you're going to cook it and it's not going to even be like it was yesterday. So for me, it's persistence, you know, it's like it's not giving back. You find those desserts and those moments where like you give it somebody else to try or even yourself you try and you're like, aha, you know, like ding, 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 like I made it. But it takes persistence and most important, like record keeping, you know, because it can happen.
Absolutely. And I think we had this in our last episode where there was a comment about this idea that Torah is the documentation of our Jewish journey, right? Like kind of the journaling of what we went through. And I know for you in this particular portion, you got very excited because there were specific lines, there were specific parts of this journey that really appealed to you. And so what was so appetizing about Akev for you? What got you so excited?
So we had 2 kids, Lucas and Elena. They are like 2.5 and 1.5, so like they are very close together. And recently in August, I started going back to work. And a lot of the work, I'm working full time, okay? So my husband still works. It's a hybrid, so there's like 3 days a week that he stays at home and he does the cooking for the dinner because he has the flexibility of like cooking and working and making it work. So, you know, I would always say, like, thank you for cooking when we were sitting. Or he would say to me, like, thank you for eating. So it started happening that all of a sudden, Luca started pointing at the plate. You know, maybe the plate had, I don't know, sweet potatoes, meat, and a salad. And he would say, who made this? Who made this? Who made this? And he would start saying, like, thank you for cooking, or thank you, mom. But, like, not even copying us, because it would be, like, later on through the meal, you know. But he would look at the plate and he wanted to know who made what to be able to thank. And it's not that we sat down and said, okay, thank dad for the meal that he cooked you. You know, I never said that, and we never neither push or guided, you know. It just didn't, I just said, oh, thank you for cooking. And to be honest, I don't think I did it every day. It was like maybe spontaneously. And I look back and every night we go through this? Who made that? Thank you. And it's such an important acknowledging of knowing it's labor, it's made with love, you know? Even if it's a quick pasta that you're just boiling the pasta and throwing tomato sauce from a can. Listen, somebody had to stand up there for 20 minutes and do the work. Otherwise, there's nothing. And I was reading this sentence in the parasha that said, when you eat and are satisfied, then bless God for the good land that God has given you. Yes. He has given me a great land that gives me all this food, but also to acknowledge the person who made it, it's such an important quality. And sometimes we overlook, you know, like, I don't think like every person who goes to somebody's house says, thank you for cooking. They say, thank you for inviting me, but it's not the same thing that saying like, thank you for cooking this meal. And, you know, my mom jokes that there's two types of people, the people who know how to cook and they made an amazing meal, and the people who know where to buy the food. And I think there's a lot of truth in that, you know, like, even if you go to a house and you say, thank you for inviting me, say that the second thank you, because the person who stood up and made it with all the love without expecting the thank you makes an entire world difference. So for me, that was like, wow, you know, like, what do we do with this? And also reading like how Moses described that, like, is this land flowing with milk and honey? So I think the first time I read it was like, because we know that Israel is the land of milk and honey, you know, it's a phrase that we all use it in the Jewish community. But I think it's different when you read it straight out of the parasha, which is, to be honest, not something that I did ever, I think, other than for my bar mitzvah or in school when I had like Torah studies. So when I read like flowing with milk and honey, I kind of thought of like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And that scene in the movie where like they go flowing that chocolate river. So, you know, I was thinking, like, it's white with the strings of honey in it. And we all, like, remembering as a little girl drinking milk and honey, you know, it's like, wow. And also milk and honey, if I think in the pastry world, are, like, two of the bigger ingredients, you know. Like, take away, like, butter, take away eggs and sugar. Like, milk and honey are there. So how important is the reference?
I'm reminded of a verse from Talmud, which says, Imein kemach in Torah, v'imein Torah in kemach. This idea that without flour, without bread, without sustenance, there's no Torah. And without Torah, there's no sustenance. That we need both things, right? And not only do we need both Torah that gives us a spiritual fulfillment and gives us structure to our lives, but we also need that, like, physical sustenance. Not only is that something that we need, but they need each other. That Torah needs physical sustenance, and that physical sustenance also needs structure and needs some kind of spiritual grounding. So I really appreciate this idea of, like, yes, we absolutely need to thank God for the land and the blessing of being able to grow our food and being able to enjoy it and be sustained by it. And we need to thank all the steps in between. There's all of this human stuff that's happening in between, and that's all just as important. I think that's such a beautiful idea.
You know, a few years ago for Israel's 70th anniversary, independence, I developed a whole, like, 7 years of history through food, okay? And how Israel culture shift through food. At that time, I didn't read at this paragraph of Akev that said, like, blessed with the seven kinds, wheat, barley, grapevines, figs, pomegranates, olive oil, and dates. But a lot of the foods that I talked there are these. And one of my major discoveries at that time was how couscous came alive. Do you guys know the story of couscous? So I think right after independence, there was a shortage in rice. Like, people were, like, very poor. and there was almost no food in there. So the Gurion spoke with us and said, listen, like, we have all these grains in here, like, do something. You need to be able to produce some food for the people so they would not starve. It will be not only for that it will feed them, but it will be also cheap for them to buy. And that's how couscous came alive, right? And that's why our couscous is so different than Moroccan couscous. Like, we have a, like, this ball that you can chew it and it has flavor, and you compare it with like Moroccan couscous and it's almost like sand. So I think if we look at those things, we can say like, okay, those seven, we're blessed with those seven kinds that really saved us at some point.
I think also that's a huge part of culture, this idea of like how our food has sustained us, right? When we discuss this, like, the whole idea of blessing after food is Birkat HaMazon. Mazon is literally sustenance. It's literally the thing that sustains us as a people. And for me, that was something that you were talking about before, is that food brings us together, but food also keeps us together. It's not just an invitation. And what's interesting is when we talk about these things, we come together not only to eat, but also to bless and to sing and to talk about how our culture really surrounds us. And an interesting thing about that is that food often comes with a story, right? When you think about your favorite food, it generally comes with a memory of a story that accompanies it. And I happen to know that you are in the process of writing a story. And so I'm curious how your love of food might have influenced your new children's book that you are working on.
So the book is called The Traveling Alfajor. And being from Buenos Aires or being from Argentina, alfajor is like couscous for Israel. It's like a staple, you know, you grow with it. And when I started working, teaching baking and pastries, I created an Airbnb experience that it was called Baking Latin Pastries. And it was awesome. I think that I had over 170 people, almost 200 people that came through the experience. And I didn't want it just to do the cooking. I wanted to give them like a takeaway, you know, like why these five different foods that we are cooking are important. Like, so I chose alfajores from Buenos Aires. I picked the churros, who has a connection between Argentina, Uruguay, and Mexico, and also Spain. I picked the chipa, which is like a pound de queso, from Brazil and Paraguay, which is like gluten-free, and I pick guava and cheese pastelitos. So I started like reading and trying to get some content so I can prepare for the class, and I was like, oh my God, like I didn't even know the story of the alfajor. And the alfajor is originally from Morocco. It was like two very, very thin wafers with almond paste on the inside that immigrated, if we wanna say, into Spain. And in Spain, they took the waffles out, but they shape it in and mix in all the nuts and spices together, a little from like the Mediterranean, Arabian side, into more of the Spanish culture. And throughout the years, with all the Spanish colonization, it made it to Argentina. And there's different reasons on how it happened in Argentina, but to me, one of the most important to believe is that nuts are very, very expensive in Argentina. It's almost like a luxury, right? So they needed to still make this trip from home that reminds them of who they are and where they come from, but to be able to afford it. And in the land of Argentina, instead of milk and honey, we have dulce de leche, which is made out of milk. And that's how the alfajor came out. And there's a whole bunch of, when I'm saying maybe there's like 20 very well-known different alfajores throughout the country. Like each region or city or state has their like specific and traditional alfajor. And I was like, oh my God, you know, as a kid, an alfajor is something that you eat nonstop. You know, you go to the little shop at the corner of your house and you buy an alfajor. You go to a baking and pastry shop and you buy an alfajor. So like it's there, but nobody knows, like nobody questions where it comes from. So education is part of who I am and what I like to do and what I like to live in the world. And I work with kids, so it was like, I need to create this. Like, we need to make this happen. And actually, the final push for writing the book was an open call for Jewish authors for books for kids. And I was like, okay, I need to give it a Jewish twist. Okay, like, so they, maybe it gets selected. So it's a seide, a grandpa, sitting around a Shabbat table, talking with their, like, the entire family, and a grandkid asks, like, seide, like, where do we come from? So around the table with food, he tells the story of how this happens. And funny, but pretty much in the 70s, with the huge immigration of Argentinians into Israel, they brought the alfajor. And if you think about it, and you close your eyes and you try to think of you walking into all the different bakeries in Israel, you're going to think that you saw an alfajor there, because it's a staple of Israeli bakeries right now. So for me, that was like, okay, this is a perfect close-up, you know? There's a family who immigrated through time and, you know, different people was born until, like, it got to Argentina and one of their kids immigrated to Israel. That's a little of the book. I'm doing a Kickstarter on the book. It has another 10 days and hopefully by then I can finally finish getting the funds to be able to publish it.
I'm so excited for this book. Like, for a lot of reasons. A, because it sounds like a great book. B, because I think food is one of those things that totally connects people together. Absolutely. We were talking about, like, sitting around the table and, like, how that brings people together. And it's also one of those things that's such a cultural identity marker. And it's, like, personally, being an Ashkenazi Jew from New England, I didn't grow up eating alfajores, but, like, I now know what they are because friends and acquaintances who are from those cultures introduce that to me.
I'm gonna give you one more reason. The book includes 5 different recipes of alfajores to cook. Because for me was that, you know, like, okay, I wanna tell people who, you know, they are either tourists or they are intrigued and bringing different cultures to their kids. Okay, not only learn and, like, Google it and show your kids a picture, let's get together into the kitchen. So I'm giving you the opportunity to have an experience with your child, to share a moment and cook an alfajor together, and then you can eat it. So I couldn't just do a children's book. It needed to be a children's book that had also those recipes.
I love that so much. I love that there's, like, an experiential component. I love that it, like, gets people moving and coming together again. I love that there's, like, cultural representation. Really, it just sounds like a wonderful project. And I know that you have a lot of things that you do. You have a lot of different projects going on. But I am wondering if you had one thing that you wanted to, like, share with the audience, if you wanted them to walk away with, like, one central message, what would that be?
It would be get in the kitchen and cook. Cook for your friends, cook for your family, cook for your colleagues, cook for whoever you wanna. But I'm sure whoever you're gonna give something that you cook, it's gonna be so grateful. And, you know, many of the stories of those, like, great bread bakers start like that. You know, they started making bread, and the more they wanted to practice, the more bread they have, and the more they share with their friends, their colleagues, their family, and, you know, it became into a business. And I buy into it. I'm proof of it. You know, my friends, every time they come home, they leave with a goodie bag of something, you know, either brownies, alfajores, bread, challah, muffins, like, whatever it is, there's always something being cooked. And get in the kitchen, give the kids the experience. If a kitchen doesn't get dirty, nothing has been cooked, okay? Because we never seen a restaurant kitchen, you know, right? When they're working, it's like, oh no, you know. But it gets dirty, like, things fall on the floor. It doesn't mean that you're gonna cook with it, but the truth is that they fall on the floor, okay? The floor gets dirty. You know, you cook with flour and it's like a snowstorm into your kitchen. And yes, oh my God, we need to clean and the kids are gonna get messy and it's gonna take 2 hours, but those memories are forever, because I remember them and I want to be able for people to leave the preconceptions on the side and be able to step into a kitchen, cook, and sit around a table and eat with your family, you know, eat with your friends, share a meal, even if it's a potluck, even more fun, you know, because we are testing, like, what you cook, what I cook, how I cook it, it's a story, it's your favorite meal, you know, like, we go back to where we started. You know, every favorite meal has a story. So when you do a potluck and you bring your food, you share, your kids made it, your kids talk about it, you talk about it, you talk with your colleagues, and they also give you ideas of how to improve it or make it better or what to add. So jump into a kitchen and cook with no utensils. You don't need much, you know, you just need the basic and you can make amazing things.
It's time to spice things up with Midrashic Mixology. This week, we are proud to present the Crushed Spirits. We'll make a quick honey syrup. I like to do this in a mason jar, equal parts by volume honey and warm water, and shake vigorously until the honey is fully dissolved. In a cocktail shaker, drop in 2 thin slices of ginger, about the size of quarters, for the 2 tablets, and muddle them up because the first ones got destroyed. Add in 2 ounces of mezcal for its smokiness, and 3/4 ounce of lime juice for the sour zing. Finally, 1 ounce of the honey syrup for the land of milk and honey. Shake with ice until it's nice and chilled, and strain into a rocks glass over ice. For a non-alcoholic version, use 2 ounces of iced green tea instead of mezcal. Garnish with 2 or more ginger slices for the 2 tablets and a lime wheel for the sun rising on a new era for the Israelites. L'chaim.
L'chaim. I can't wait to step out of the podcast and go do it. I actually have mezcal at home and this sounds like the perfect treat.
I had never had mezcal before starting this podcast. And I got so into it. And I know that you living in Miami are saying like, Gabe, you've never had mezcal? What's wrong with you?
Listen, have you tried mezcal and hibiscus flower?
No.
Jamaican hibiscus? Oh my God. You know the Jamaican hibiscus, like the tea, the pink one?
Yeah.
Okay, with mezcal?
Okay. Well, you get 2 drinks this week on Midrashic Mixology, so best day ever.
In Torah, there's kind of a rule that a parsha is never supposed to end on a downer, and so we certainly couldn't end with crushed spirits, no matter how good a drink that it sounds like it is. We want to make sure to lift your spirits a little, so we're coming at you with thank yous and closing cues, which, as you know, you might have noticed is a little bittersweet because it means we're coming close to the end of our episode. So, Romy, Gabe, in Akev, we're meant to remember our blessings, but also to be mindful of when enough is enough, right? We're supposed to have something, bless, and then realize, like, we are sated, we're good. So what's your recipe for mindful success? Romy, we'll start with you.
My recipe for mindful success, as much of a cliche as it will sound, is I have two. One is to close my eyes and count to 10, to let go the moment and realize the magnitude, if it's worth or not. And the second one is, even if I'm tired and I need to debrief, I get into, we have at home like a little bakery. It has a stainless steel counter and it has like a kitchen rug, like in the kitchens, and I have all my toys in there. So I'll, chances are that I'll close the door and get in there at night after everybody is sleeping and cook something. You know, I need it. It's my way of relaxing, as much not relaxing as it is.
Beautiful. And I think that that can be a wonderful recipe for success, is the reminder that we don't always need to be pumping through productivity. Like, there is the ability to rest and relax as a reward for a hard week's work.
Yes. And, you know, I think that's the reason why, or one of the reasons why making challah, eat on Thursday and Friday. You know, it's a way of letting go, but it's also providing something nourishing and saying like, okay, you know, with this last bake, I make my closing for the week.
Beautiful. Gabe, how about you?
I think for me, the most helpful thing is to really name what I'm experiencing, to really be explicit about, you know, if I'm eating something and I want to be mindful about how I'm eating or what I'm eating. Really naming, this is what this tastes like. This is what it feels like in my mouth. This is like really what I'm experiencing as specifically as I can. Because not only does that help me be like more mindful and more thoughtful about what I'm eating or about what I'm doing, but it also helps me appreciate and enjoy it more. It helps me be more grateful for what I have and for what I'm able to do, to really think about each individual piece. It's really special to think about all of the little tiny things that go into these larger experiences that we have in our lives.
Beautiful. As somebody who often is eating with you on a couch while watching TV to try to relax at the end of the day, I know we try to talk about mindful eating or moving our locations, but it's important for us to remember that it's okay to click off and do one thing at a time. And I think that we don't always remember to do that well. And so I think for me, I have a really interesting space of coming from mentors who range from never be complacent, right? Never be like okay with just the success that you have, to celebrate every single win. And I think one of the ways that I found the balance for that is from Demir and Carrie Bentley, who run something called, you know, the Life Hack Method. And they talked about champagne moments. Like, what's the one thing that if you did it this week, you know, you could pop open a bottle of champagne or a bottle of Martinelli's sparkling apple cider, if that's your jam, you know, that to celebrate that you made it through this week, you won the week. And if you get that one thing done, right, like that's the celebration. It's not the daily grind. And you might have a champagne moment every day if you're lucky enough to have those moments. But having one a week is still a win. That means, by the way, that if you had one every single week that you met, that's a bottle of champagne or cider, 52, man, 52 bottle popping moments. That's a lot for anybody. That's an incredible success rate if you think about it. And that's once a week, just one win a week. And that's, for me, a way that I've tried to redefine success as somebody who I think hustles a lot and puts in the grind. Trying to remember when enough is enough is an important moment. And like Romy, I try to give myself those moments on Fridays as my, like, treat yourself day, my celebration day, my champagne moment day. And also having good friends to remind me, hey, you've done a really good job. You're doing good work. Atta girl, atta person, atta boy for Gabe, because that's always his favorite compliment. You know, these are conversations that I wish more people would have of, hey, success is success, whatever you make of it. And the recipe for success is always going to be different for someone else. And maybe you need to try it 200 times before it tastes right to you. And maybe you need to journal and document it. But the conversations can be helpful when you realize you're not in it alone. And so, Romy, if people want to continue the conversation with you, how could they find or follow you?
You can find me on Instagram at La Romy Bakery, Romy with an I, R-O-M-I, and then bakery. Or you can send me an email into info@laromybakery.com.
Incredible. I'll make sure to have those in the show notes. You can always check our show notes for people's contact information or for interesting, fun links. Romy, any last words, thoughts, concerns, or jokes that you want to share?
Thank you for having me. Thank you for this opportunity. And I really hope, and I always say this, if you're cooking or if you want to cook and you have, you know, the internet is a big place. So if you rather go into a trusted recipe, send me an email or a message on Instagram and I'll be happy to share a recipe with you. So I want everybody to be cooking. So.
Incredible. And I can also say that Romy runs really wonderful, interactive online cooking sessions if ever you're interested, because I've seen those happen. Thank you, Romy. Thank you for such a delightful evening, a delightful episode recording. Thank you so much to Gabe for being an incredible co-host and also cook in this particular apartment. Thank you to Idan, even though he's not here, for helping everyone get set up and making sure that we're still running on time. Thank you to Kate for making us sound brilliant. We appreciate your editing more than you know. And thank you to all of our listeners. We'll be back with you soon for our conclusion. Stay tuned. Gabe, I was really excited about this particular episode, and especially Romy. And I know that I gave you full information about her before we got started, but watching your face, which the audience can't see, get more and more smiley the more Romy talked about cooking and community and connection was delightful for me.
I mean, everything she said was just so resonant. And I know I said, like, yeah, my dad's in education and my mom was a cook. And so, like, I get that. Like, I have that personal connection there. But I think that's actually, like, a really universal thing, that everybody has some sort of connection to food. Even people who are, like, really picky eaters, like, still have a taste or a smell that, like, brings them back to childhood or connects them with a really important memory.
And I just want to put this out there for people who, honestly, this episode might be a struggle for. We recognize that people sometimes don't always have great connections to food. In fact, some people might have disordered eating. Some people may have memories of hunger or food scarcity. Like, we recognize that food is an important resource and often an undervalued resource, and it's not always so easy to get. That's one of the things that we repeatedly hear in our Torah portions. You know, people are hungry, looking for food, complaining about the food that they might get. And it's generally still a part of our story, whether it's good, whether it's bad, it's there.
I would also say that a big part of this Torah portion is God explaining God's cause. And that's the cause of the orphan and the widow and the stranger. It's the cause of these people who sometimes need a little extra help. And so really, it's our duty, it's our job as people who want to follow the law or follow the ethics or follow the values that were passed down to us to really take care of those in need.
Absolutely. And when we talked about rewinding to the past, this idea of be fruitful and multiply, and I know that I punned it out a little bit, but there is something to be said about this idea of when we support each other, we're able to grow stronger and we're able to grow more.
You know, I am reminded, because you're talking about Genesis, you're talking about be fruitful and multiply, I'm remembering the expulsion from Eden. And I'm remembering that the biggest part of God's punishment to Adam, to the first man who was expelled from the garden, was saying, you're going to have to work for your food now. You're going to have to fight with thistles and branches, and you're going to have to toil and work the land for your food. And I think it's really a beautiful thing that you said, that we grow together when we help each other. And it reminds me that, like, coming together really does bring us closer to that Eden, to that paradise, to how creation was really supposed to be.
I think so too. And I think that as we're coming to the close of this episode, you know, we invite all of you to check out some of the offerings that we have. We know we've gotten a little behind, a lot behind on our drinks page, but don't worry, we're going to make sure that our recipes get up there soon. Even if all the artwork isn't available just yet, Gabe's working on it one step at a time. But there's so much to offer there. Our episodes are there, our About Us and Why We Do This Work is there. Our thanks are there to the people who have supported us. Thank you especially to the Be Wise Foundation and to Men of Reformed Judaism, who have given us a lot of financial support and also emotional support. Thank you to HEC, who's made sure that we're able to keep doing this day by day. Thank you to all of our listeners who have helped us grow. It's been a wonderful thing to read about people who listen to us every week. We hope you share it. Help us grow. Help us multiply and be fruitful so that we can keep bringing you this incredible content. And hey, if you ever want to share your story of how you take ownership of your Judaism in your own terms in your own time, make sure that you go to www.drinkinganddrashing.com. Press that contact button. We want to hear from you. We're happy to highlight your voice and lift up your own experience. We're so excited that you've been part of our story, and we can't wait to keep sharing other stories. Stay tuned, get excited, make sure that you are keeping on cooking in the kitchen, and hey, don't forget to raise that glass while you're at it. L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Hi, I'm Romina Barstek, and you're listening to Drinking and Rushing Torah with a Twist, and I really think everybody should be cooking and enjoying the process as much as the product and thanking for it.